Oborne and Heller on Cricket, brought to you by the Chiswick Calendar.
Hello, it's Peter Oborne here on a very frosty day in Wiltshire.
Hello, it's Richard Heller on a pretty frosty day in London's southeast.
Now we've got a most unusual guest, a most unusual and wonderful story to tell today, Richard.
We certainly have. It's a genuine thrill to welcome today the director of what is surely one of the most remarkable cricket projects anywhere in the world. It's centred in the Shatila refugee camp in Lebanon, a place which is teeming with humanity, many of them in a desperate condition, a place with no cricketing background, but it's a place in which children's lives are beginning to be transformed by cricket. That's why it is a thrill, as I say, to welcome Richard Verity.
Good morning, Richard. It's lovely to have you.
Good morning, Peter. Good morning, Richard. It's very nice to be here and a privilege, in fact, to be here. I've listened to many of the other podcasts that you have done, and I feel I'm honoured to be part of the sequence.
Now tell us, how is it, the Shatila refugee camp in southern Beirut, been the scene of so much suffering and so much horror in times, particularly one thinks, of course, of the massacre in 1982, but it's very, very crowded. It's probably the least, one of the places in the world I've been there. I went there, I visited about 10 years ago. Very crowded, in parts a little menacing, full of humanity, full of joy as well, but not normally, not historically associated with cricket. How did this come about?
Yeah. So first, a few words about Shatila. I think you described it extraordinarily well. Yeah. It's a refugee camp. It's no longer tents. It's a kind of Dickensian slum. It's run by 12 Palestinian factions. It's very poor. It has far too many guns, far too many drugs, and it's curiously governed. The Lebanese government does not actually manage the camp, and therefore the police cars and the ambulances stay on the outside. They don't go inside. But it's also a place where many Syrian refugees live, where originally many Palestinian refugees also live. It's about 50-50 between the two. And it's a place where our children currently are playing cricket. Now, how on earth did I end up there? How on earth did these children start playing cricket? I think I have to confess to a midlife crisis round about the summer of 2018. At that stage, I had been a management consultant for well over 20 years, and I had lived during the week at least in expensive hotels and spent my days in headquarters trying to improve shareholder value for large companies, a worthy task, but one that left me slightly unsatisfied. I wanted to do something that had more immediate social impact. And fortunately, I synchronized my midlife crisis with that of my wife. Micah speaks Arabic. She is a writer, and she's also was running a publishing company, living in comfortable circumstances in North London. And she too felt that sense of dissatisfaction, that sense that we wanted to do something more. I had an opportunity to become the temporary CEO of an NGO in Lebanon. The founder was going to spend a year away doing academic work. And initially I declined the offer, but then ultimately I accepted it. And it felt at the time a very brave move. I mean, not the right way to treat a McKinsey career. And I also
McKinsey's felt, being pretty well the most famous management consultancy firm in the world, I think.
Well,
of which you were a partner, I think I'm right in saying.
In which I was a partner, and yeah, it's a career that is full of interest. It's also extremely fragile. You're subject to the up or out mechanisms of the evaluation process, and leaving for a year felt like a risky thing to do. So we arrived in Beirut. I found myself managing this NGO, and I found myself also spending a great deal of time thinking about donor strategies, thinking about job descriptions, thinking about management processes, as if I were a management consultant, and finding myself still at one remove from the people that I was trying to help. So I had an idea, one of the few brilliant ideas of my life, that there was perhaps one activity that I could do with Syrian refugee children that didn't require Arabic, didn't require language. And that was teaching cricket. So for a week, we had a cricket camp, which was run by Ratan Shahadul from Capital Kids Cricket. It was sponsored by McKinsey. And the first day, about 20 children turned up to this cricket camp, wide-eyed, slightly mystified, not terribly enthusiastic. The second day, 120 children turned up because news travels fast in Shatila. And this was clearly quite an entertaining way of spending time. At the end of the 5 days of this cricket camp, and it was only meant to last 5 days, there was a tremendous gap in my life. I had massively enjoyed working with the Arabic-speaking coaches. I had more than massively enjoyed engaging with the children. And the feelings were reciprocated. So after a few days of gap, myself and Mohammed Hariri, we decided that we would start weekly cricket sessions for perhaps 20 children. That wasn't enough. We decided to expand to 2 cricket sessions, 3 cricket sessions. We started building new hubs. And within the space of about, 12 months, we found ourselves teaching in Shatila, in Burj El Barajni, in Bekaa. And we now have, I think, roughly 200 children in different parts of Lebanon being taught cricket.
Richard, I think you're too modest about your capacity for brilliant ideas, but this was certainly one of them. Richard, it's rather counterintuitive to bring cricket to an environment which has got no experience of cricket and to children who've had no experience of cricket, but in a way, it was the very strangeness of cricket and the newness of cricket that was a factor in its success, wasn't it?
Yes. I mean, so I had to rethink almost everything about cricket when I brought it to the Syrian refugees. They, of course, have no context. They couldn't pronounce the word. They had no knowledge of the rules. And they certainly had none of the positive nor the negative connotations that cricket can generate in some circumstances. It wasn't a colonial game. It was just an interesting game brought in from the outside, something that perhaps they could master. But cricket, as we know, Richard and Peter, is a remarkable game. It is a game that allows girls and boys to play together, certainly at the ages that we're talking about, between 10 and 15. It's a game that allows speed, but you don't have to be fast. You can also be slow and still play a role in the game. It's a game that requires respect between players, both on your own team and also between teams. So it's a wonderful education in creating harmonious social relations. I think the more that I've coached cricket, and probably more from coaching cricket than playing cricket, the more I have realised what a mysterious, almost mystical game it can be in creating impacts, positive impacts for those who are involved in it. And this is particularly the case with those Syrian refugee children who, the girls, they had no other competitive sport that they could play, no other competitive team sport. And the boys, well, most of them had some passing association with football, but they found something different in cricket. They found a technical difficulty which they could then master that gave them a great sense of self-worth. And they found, as we all have found, an exciting game that simply improves the more you play it.
I've seen some of the videos of the children playing, and it's amazing, Richard. I mean, a young girl of 12 years old bowling
fast and accurately on the stumps on a good length and loving it. It's quite something. It's quite something to witness.
It's quite something. Well, and Peter, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because there are many interventions with refugees that are, they have an element of condescension, particularly the sporting interventions. They're there to give the children a safe space. They're there to give the children a run around in the open air. One of the things that I was very clear about when I started seriously teaching cricket to Syrian refugees was that we were going to do this properly. We were going to teach children cricket, not a version of cricket. We were going to set them up in matches within a month of starting. And we were going to create cricket teams that were going to beat other cricket teams in Lebanon, and ultimately, inshallah, beat other cricket teams that might tour from England or elsewhere. So we were going to strive for excellence. And as soon as the children realized that, well, that added a whole new layer of excitement to what they were doing.
It certainly did. And it's given some of the children the experience of leadership and mentorship and indeed captaincy, which they might not have got in any other way, in any other phase of their life. I've had the opportunity to talk to some of your young Syrian cricketers a couple of days ago, Richard, and it was a wonderful experience through the miracle of Zoom. They were in Shatila, I was in London, and first I spoke to Luai. Luai's 15, he's lived in the Shatila camp for 5 years. His family escaped from Raqqa when he was 10, and I asked him what his life had been like in Syria and why they'd had to leave.
He said that because of the war in Syria started and the existence of ISIS. ISIS were very bad. They were preventing them from living the good life they want. So they came to Lebanon in order to have a good life. He said that he wants to continue his life, he wants to progress in his life, don't want to be under pressure all the time because of ISIS.
I understand that. If you had stayed, would you have been made to join ISIS?
He might be forced to join ISIS because they were prevented from doing anything. They were prevented from playing. They were prevented from doing a lot of things.
Was he prevented from playing sport too?
Yes.
Yep. Let's talk about cricket now. I bet you'd never seen cricket before you came to the camp, or probably even heard of it. Is that right?
No, he never heard about the cricket. And also, when he was in Raqqa, he was, as I told you, forbidden from playing even football. So he didn't have an opportunity to play football. So when he came in Lebanon, he started to know a lot of things. He started to play football first, and then he turned into the cricket after Richard brought the cricket to Shatila camp.
That's great. I've seen video of Luai bowling, and tell him he's got a very, very good action. He's got a very fast action. He'd scare a lot of batsmen that I play with, I can tell you that. Is that what he likes doing best, being a bowler, or are you a batsman as well? And has he got a magic ball that always gets people out?
Akit.
Yes.
That looks like, I'm trying to do it that way, that looks like a leg break or a leg cutter, as we would say in English. And it looks.
I think he meant spin.
Spin, yeah. Have you played any organised matches yet? Matches against other teams?
Because we have about 3 or 4 hubs in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. So he played against these hubs and he said he never lose once.
You've never lost?
No.
That's a great record. Now, I think you were captain in at least one of those matches, weren't you?
Mostly.
Mostly, okay.
Mostly he was the captain. When he entered the cricket for the first time, he wants to forget the times that he lived in Syria, the times with ISIS. But now he has a passion to be a cricket player. He wants to progress himself. He wants to develop himself to be a good player.
Mm. Has cricket helped you to concentrate at school, and has it helped you in your life outside school as well?
Yes, it helped him a lot. And thanks to Richard, and we have Coach Qadriya who gave him a psychological support that turned him from a child into a young man. Mm. And now he realizes more about the life, and he knows his goal now.
Good. You've watched a lot of cricketers, you said, on video, and you've learned a lot from them. Which cricketer did you most like watching on video? Which cricketer do you most imitate?
Jafra.
Jafra Archer? Okay. Lou, I'll just say thank you. Shukran. Very best of luck in your future life.
He's thanking you for giving him this opportunity.
Louis' ambition is now to be a professional cricketer, he told me, and if he can't do that, then to teach it. And I think he'd have every success if he did. I then spoke to Maram, who is 14, and she's also been at Shatila for 5 years. And she also wants to be a cricket coach and possibly also a singer. Cricket's made a huge difference to her confidence and her prospects. And she also told me what her life had been like in Syria.
She said it was very hard to live with ISIS because you could see cutting the heads and cutting the hands of some people. Also, they were prevented from wearing colorful clothes, only black. So it was very difficult, and she don't wish anyone to live this life.
I don't suppose she was allowed to play any sport. Yeah, under ISIS.
Definitely.
No, of any sort, no. And so let's go on to happier times. Is cricket your favourite sport?
Yes.
Yes, her favourite is the cricket.
Yes.
The cricket helped her in concentration of her lessons, and also physically helped her a lot. And also of her background, the girls were prevented from playing with the boys the same game. But in the cricket, it's all changed. Richard have invited her family to see Maram in the playground and see there is a safe place for her to play with the boys and to be accepted from the boys as a friend, not as what they imagine.
That's wonderful. Does she like watching cricket online as well? Is she a Rajasthan Royals fan too?
أنتي مشجعة على Rajasthan Royals ولا لا؟
أكيد.
Now, because of the lockdown now, she can't go to the playground, so she watches cricket all the time.
My favorite team.
Yeah, okay. And definitely she is a Rajasthan Royal fan.
Okay. Who's her favorite Rajasthan Royals player?
Jofra.
Jofra again. He's got a big fan club. Maram, I'm told that you're very good at English and very good at creative writing. And I've heard you say a beautiful poem in English about Syria. Would you like to say it for us?
I come from Syria, from death and war. I come from horror, from explosion and killing. I come from black smoke, from broken houses. I came afraid for my doll. I come from the living, from jasmine roses. I come from the land of refugees, land of love and tenderness, the land of dialects and religions, the land of delicious cooking. It is Syria.
Wonderful. Maram, shukran. Thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you for you.
Maram lives in a house with three families, many children, lots of noise, no quiet place to study for her, but she's never once been late with her homework. And finally, I talked to Amani. Amani is 15. She's also been at the camp for 5 years. And we also talked about her childhood in a war zone under ISIS.
It was difficult for her, especially for the girls. They were prevented from removing the black color from her clothes. And even this mask of her face should not remove it, even in front of her brothers. And the men were prevented from smoking. Also, she said a lot of girls were taken to marriage by force to the ISIS. And whoever says no, being punished. When the girl grow up, there's no a certain age, but when she is a grown up, she can be forced to marriage.
She was 11 when she left, 16 now, I think she said, 5 years ago, 11 when she left. Might she have been married by ISIS when she was 11?
Yes, she will be. And also some girls of 11 and 12 years old were married.
Mm. Well, you've been playing cricket, though, now for, I think, just over 2 years. Is that right?
Yes, and she's our best female player.
Mm. I've seen some video of Amani bowling. She's got a very dynamic action too. And I'm told, Amani, that you're known as the Storm on the field.
Yes.
Why do people call you the Storm?
Because when she goes out, she don't see anyone in the playground. She only see the ball, the bat, and the wicket.
I think I also heard that you're known as the General because you're a captain as well, aren't you? And you organise players very, very well.
Yes.
Yes. And you captain boys as well as girls. And you tell them, in England, some boys don't like taking orders from girls, but they take orders from you. Is that right? Or take directions from you. You tell them where to field or where to bowl or whatever.
Shatila, we have a different situation. They have learned to accept each other. They have learned to accept taking commands or taking instructions from the girl. The boys, of course, and all that with the effort of our coaches.
Mm. That's wonderful. That's through playing cricket. That's what cricket taught him. What else has cricket taught you, Amani? How has it helped you at school? Does it help you to concentrate? Tell us what it's done for you in school and your life.
Cricket helped me to be very strong.
The cricket taught her to be strong.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing I've found in cricket is it helps if you do anything good in cricket, or even if you just play it at all, it does help you forget a lot of other things in your life that aren't going so well. When you're playing it, you can think only about playing cricket. Does that work for her too? Does it help her to forget anything that's painful or difficult?
Yes, the cricket have made her forget all the things she had saw in Syria, and the blood, all the blood and the war they were in Syria. And when she enters the playground, she becomes another person.
Amani, are you another Rajasthan Royals fan?
أنت من مشجعين راجستان رويال؟
Yeah.
And I'll have to ask you, just to complete the set, who's your favourite Rajasthan Royals player?
Jofra.
Another Jofra, right. We've got, this is it, he's got a fan club. Thank you, Amani, Shakran, again. Thank you to all of you, and very good luck in your future lives.
Thank you.
Richard, these three children are a wonderful advertisement for the project, but you've witnessed a great change in all three of them, haven't you, since they were involved in cricket?
Yeah. So they are a wonderful advertisement. They're also typical of the larger population of children that we teach. I mean, I was smiling all the way through those interviews. What did I take from them? So Amani, let's start with Amani. So when I first met Amani, she was not an easy person to coach, and she's still quite tricky to coach, very self-willed. When she's let out onto the playground, for the first 5 or 10 minutes, I mean, she is running about, teasing others, rather like kind of a young horse entering a hayfield. I mean, lovely to see, but uncoachable for a while. And then, and she continues to have that kind of that vibrancy in life, even while she's playing. So when she's fielding, she very often finds herself doing little dances between deliveries. But she also provided me, I think, with one of the, yeah, with one of the kind of the sharpest moments that reminded me why I'm doing this, why we are doing this. So she was the first girl to realize that she could run up and bowl, not just bowl from a standing position. And so she did that. She ran up, she bowled with a full follow through, and the ball travelled to the far end, too fast for the batsman to hit. And then she was slightly startled. She then turned, looked at me, clapped her hands, and had this expression of pride and satisfaction and amazement and happiness, which is with me still. Those kinds of moments where children literally transform themselves in front of your eyes are, of course, the reason why we continue.
So moving. You know, I spent a lot of time in the last 5 years in Syria, and I talked to a lot of families from ISIS, including one. I remember 5 years ago outside the Umayyad Mosque in Damascus meeting a family who had just come out of Raqqa. And it had been they said they'd gone through 14 checkpoints on the way out, and they described how they were interrogated at each time. They had to return because otherwise they'd lose their house. And then they described the executions they were forced to watch. The young women, to get so-called married, they basically were turned into sex objects for the ISIS soldiers. That's what the fate of those two girls might well have been. And the young men, many of them would just be sent off. There was no schooling, but they'd be sent off to be indoctrinated and very likely turned into suicide bombers. That was the fate awaiting those children under ISIS. And to hear them talking so joyfully about playing cricket is just unbelievable.
Just unbelievable. And I have to say, I mean, those interviews were news to me. So Richard gently interviewing those children was extracting facts about their Syrian existence that I was not aware of. So I found it very moving, particularly Maram. Maram is a sweet-tempered girl with a beautiful smile. And to hear her talking about ISIS in such a kind of matter-of-fact way was remarkable to me. And also to hear that poem, by the way. I mean, her memory of Syria is a complex memory.
The land of beautiful food and so on. It was it expressed, you know, both the joy of Syria, which of course is one of the most ancient civilizations in the world, at the same time as the horror that it's gone through recently.
Exactly, exactly. And for a child to be able to articulate both sides, the black smoke and broken houses, as well as the jasmine roses and the beautiful cooking, I think that shows remarkable maturity. And these children never cease to surprise me, in truth. They surprise me for that maturity. They also surprise me for their enthusiasm. I mean, their willingness to learn both cricket on the one side, but also the academic subjects on the other, is far in excess of the willingness of a normal Western child to learn, who takes education as something for granted. These children know that education is not to be taken for granted. And when they get the opportunity, they embrace it with an energy that makes teaching them extremely fulfilling.
So fascinating, listening to Richard talking to those young people. Now, the coaching, you sent over some videos ahead of this of it happening, and I was incredibly struck by them being coached in Arabic by a gentleman who had a perfect, immaculate backward defence. And so he clearly knew cricket and he knew Arabic, which in itself isn't, and he was speaking fluently Arabic. That's not very usual in itself.
No, well, indeed. So let's be clear. I mean, none of the children knew cricket. None of the coaches knew cricket either.
Well, really? So he'd learnt, he was an Arab, he's an Arab who's learnt cricket in order to coach, yeah.
Exactly. So the coaching challenge here is really quite an interesting one. So you find yourself on day one with about 40 children in the playground. You're supported by three keen Arabic-speaking coaches, one of whom might speak English. And you have to teach cricket every single part of it. I mean, how to hit, how to run, how to field, how to score. And we have, and we are still learning how to do that, yeah, because the kind of approaches that I might have taken as a volunteer cricket coach in my past simply don't work terribly well. You are assuming too much if you're assuming that they know how to hold a bat or how to bowl a ball. Mm. So what we have found is that we need to take a very structured approach to coaching, rather like the Suzuki approach to teaching violin. So we teach the movements of cricket as if they were ballet. Every single child in the playground will do a bowling action with a straight right arm. Every single child in the playground will do a forward defensive, backward defensive. And then the challenge is to convert those movements, usually done without a ball, into movements that are actually useful in a match. So we then progress on to exercises where they actually do the bowling or do the batting. And then finally, they progress into a match. And the real challenge is to make those artificial movements into useful movements for them in a match. And of course, at the very start, that doesn't work well. They forget everything they've been taught and they swing across the line, and it's quite disappointing. But over time, and with continuous coaching, they learn actually really rather well how to do the strokes, and they then convert that into a match performance. So the coaches are following a journey that mirrors the journey of the children. So they are learning, hopefully a little faster than the children, what the strokes are, what the rules are, what the pleasures of the game are. And then they're able to communicate that to the children. These coaches are simply the children 10 years older. They are themselves Syrian refugees. They too have gone through, perhaps with more consciousness, I mean, the horrors of the Syrian civil war. And they too are getting or feeling the impact of the positive impact of the cricket game. And also the positive impact of teaching this very willing group of children. They're now passionate about the game for its own sake. One of the coaches, Mohammed Hariri, the first coach, managed to obtain asylum in Italy. So he is now teaching refugees in Italy how to play cricket. So it's the beginning of the first beginings of the Syrian cricket diaspora.
I'm assuming that many of these, they're Syrian children or Syrian young people, they escaped from ISIS. Well, but I'm guessing, because it's Shatila, which is a Palestinian camp, that they were probably at Yarmouk, were they? The Palestinian refugee camp in Damascus, a lot of them.
That's right. So, and many of the coaches actually came from Yarmouk too.
Yeah, because ISIS took over Yarmouk, and it became a war zone. Yeah.
Indeed. And that's when many of them fled. So yes, when we say Syrians, we mean in some cases Palestinian refugees from Syria who've now become refugees in Lebanon, and some are just Syrians.
Yeah. Now, what I was also gripped by, and perhaps you could explain it a bit more, here they are. They're all fans of Jofra Archer, the great England fast bowler, the wonderful, exhilarating fast bowler, and the Rajasthan Royals. Now, how does that happen?
Well, it's because Manoj Badali, the owner of the Rajasthan Royals,
lives in Chiswick, I think. I think he and I were both parents of children at the same school at one stage, or a child, yeah.
There we are. Well, his son, maybe, is Harry Badali. Harry Badali and Manoj have paid interest to the Shatila cricket. And indeed, Harry Badali has come on Zoom calls and helped coach our coaches. So when we invested at the beginning of this year, or at the end of last year, rather, in a television with a satellite dish, we were very clear that there was one Indian Premier League team to support. It was the Rajasthan Royals. And sure enough, the children did. And again, that produced another just wonderful moment. I don't know if some of your listeners will watch, perhaps, the moment where the Rajasthan Royals played against the Punjab Kings 11. And it was, a 3-hour 2020 match. It was the first time that these children had ever seen a cricket match. I was a little nervous. I thought that maybe they would find even a 2020 slightly dull. And they didn't know any of the players at that stage. Well, they were enthralled, and it was an enthralling match. And by the end, they were literally standing on their chairs.
No, I've seen the footage, yeah.
It was a wonderful match, but with a wonderful response from the children. And and I can't explain why, out of all the remarkable players in the Rajasthan Royals, Jofra Archer was their favourite. I think, he is, of course...
Oh, it's that languid run-up.
Two fast bowlers among those children. He's a very good model for them, certainly. Yeah. And he's just a very dynamic and exciting player for anybody to follow, isn't he?
And the way he hits sixes without even trying.
All of those things. Anyway, so he became a personal favourite. As did, there were a few others as well. I mean, so Faf du Plessis sent us a video telling the Shatila children to play hard and play well. So
well done him, yeah.
I think Tom Curran gave you some time as well, didn't he?
And Tom Curran zoomed in just before one of the Rajasthan Royals. So it doesn't take much for our children to latch on to a player. And the three I've just mentioned, Tom Curran, Faf du Plessis, Jofra Archer, without yet having a connection with us, are the three almost all the children would praise.
Now, tell me something else. So Shatila is such an enclosed area, people everywhere. Where do you find the place to play? Where do you find the space?
Yeah, well, so we don't play on a manicured cricket pitch with a square, clearly. What we have, though, is AstroTurf football pitches. And there's one of those in Shatila, and there's one of those just outside Shatila. And these pitches are actually ideal for the kind of cricket that we're wanting to play. We're playing with either a tennis ball, a tape ball, or an incredible, depending on the on the maturity of the team that we're talking about, and we play with runs being scored against the walls, back walls. So now, and as I say that, I worry that many people might think this isn't quite proper cricket. This isn't going to be competitive cricket. Actually, the skills required to play with a tape ball, with an incredible, are really very similar to the skills required to play with a hard ball.
Oh, yeah.
You can swing the ball, you can spin the ball, you need all the strokes. The tactics are different but also real and need to be able to mark.
And Richard and I have played and watched tape ball in Pakistan. It's serious cricket.
It's serious cricket. And one day, who knows, we will find ourselves on a grass pitch and be able to play with a hard ball, but not quite yet.
But you're expanding beyond Shatila, aren't you? You're going out and very successfully, I think.
Yes, we are. So, at the moment we have five hubs. The MCC Foundation, led by Sarah Fain, just sponsored.
Who did so much in Afghanistan.
Yes.
Yeah.
So
and we interviewed her, yeah.
There are two organisations, one Women Win from the Netherlands. How on earth did they end up sponsoring a cricket hub? Well, they just saw what this sport was doing for the girls. And the MCC Foundation, led by Sarah Fain, that was particularly meaningful because she has seen cricket in a refugee environment. She has helped build Afghanistan cricket. And the fact that she saw potential for Lebanese cricket is, I hope, a good omen for us. We might build something similar to what she built in Afghanistan.
Well, you have the ambition, don't you, of making Lebanon a cricket nation, making Lebanon an associate member. I think you even want to send a team to the Los Angeles Olympics, don't you?
A female cricket team in 2024, wouldn't that be amazing? There is no reason why refugee cricket in Lebanon, and why not let's include Iraq and Turkey, couldn't be as successful as refugee cricket in Afghanistan. Now, we don't have a cricketing country next door. We don't have the kind of the continuous cricket media coverage that I'm sure you get in Pakistan and you now get in Afghanistan. But everything else, a very young population, very interested in the outside world, with time on their hands. This refugee cricket, I think, is an area of real potential growth for the game, as well as an opportunity for the societies that actually embrace it.
Now, can I ask a question? Can we come and play you? I yearn to come and play at Chatila.
We might be very heavily outgunned, Peter. You know, we've seen the videos, and we've interviewed three of the players now, our opponents now.
So I've been offering in an airy kind of way all sorts of teams, including my own club, North Middlesex Cricket Club, who is at the moment raising money for Chatila cricket with and trying to engage with our children as coaches. No one has yet, and for obvious reasons, no one has yet visited us. No cricket team visited us. Coronavirus is one reason, but also a certain anxiety and concern about going into Chatila or going into the tent camps in Becca. Peter and Richard, we would love you to come. I think Chatila is a place to see before you die, and also the refugee camps in Becca as well. You've seen them, Peter. Richard, you would be fascinated by them. You'd be fascinated by the resilience of the children. And you would love to play cricket against our children, as they would love to play cricket against you.
Oh, I'd love to. I'd love to. And we could bring some of our children, our youngsters, along, maybe.
I'd especially love to go to Lebanon because two of my grandparents were born there. One in Beirut, one in Zakhle, in the Bekaa Valley.
So you have cousins, yes. Richard?
Distant cousins. My grandparents immigrated.
Your real name is Rashid, something you've been keeping from.
My first name, my grandfather's name should be, my grandfather's called Rashid originally. And it, like so many immigrants to the United States, his name was Americanized as soon as he reached Ellis Island.
It's something you should know about Richard Verity. You need Richard Heller. His grandparents emigrated to the United States. His father was a very successful TV producer, but driven out by McCarthyism and had to go and live, which took him to eventually by various circumlocutions to Britain. Mm-hmm. After World War II.
Yep. But, Richard, you've been able to expand the original camp and you've got other cricket hubs. One of the cricketing centres, though, is a little bit different from the others, and that's the one at Bramana School. Could you tell us a bit about that one?
Yes. So when I said that, I mean, all our cricketers were Syrians or Palestinians, that's not entirely true. There is one cricket hub that is mostly Lebanese, some international children there too. Bramana High School is the Eton of Lebanon. It's where many of the politicians send their children. It's a really excellent school with great facilities and great teaching, and also a great headmaster in David Gray. I contacted David Gray and made him a proposition. The proposition was that myself and the Syrian cricket coaches would come and teach his children how to play cricket. He himself is also a cricketer, so he's one of the coaching team there, on condition that his children would come and play against ours. And at that stage, our cricket team was called the Chatila Cricket Club. And I'm afraid to say that the parents of the children rebelled when they heard that they were going to play Chatila Cricket Club, because Chatila is a place of controversy and danger as far as they were concerned. So we changed the name and we are now calling ourselves, the most recent name is the Al Thamar Cricket Club, to connect us with the school that we've now just set up. And The Brumana children have now played cricket against our children from Shatila. I'm happy to tell you that they were beaten badly, which is a wonderful...
Shatila won.
Shatila won. Shatila
Osama won. Let's put it diplomatically.
Osama were much the better team for the moment. They started much earlier than Brumana. And I took great pleasure in the inversion of the usual hierarchy. I mean, normally the Syrian refugees do not win in any kind of competition that involves wealthy Lebanese children. This time they did, and I'm looking forward to a lot of future matches with them because they will get better, and they're a sweet group of children too, it must be said, with great English as well, which makes them much easier to coach for me than the Syrian children.
Richard, we're going to have many, many listeners who are going to want to support the project, and we're certainly going to put your link for this purpose to put that out with the podcast. But tell us a little bit about your ambitions for it and what you would do with that extra support.
So we would love to expand the cricket. I mean, we have a waiting list of hundreds of children who would love to play cricket, but they can't get into the playground because the playground only fits so many, and we can only afford to pay for a certain number of coaches. So at the moment we have 5 hubs. We would love to expand to 20 hubs. Why not? 1,000 children. And really begin to create the kind of cricket environment in which teams thrive. Teams thrive, leagues thrive. We would love to do more with the female cricket, and as you mentioned, the possibility of having our women's team play international cricket is a real one, I think. I mean, we have the talent, we don't yet have the access to those competitions. In addition to that, and this is a cautionary tale for anyone who gets involved with Al-Samar or Syrian refugees, what my wife and I have found is that the more we commit, the more we want to commit. So we have now set up Shatila's first and only secondary school for about 150 of the Shatila children. And that, of course, allows us to impact these children beyond just sport. They're learning English, they're learning Arabic, they're learning maths, they're learning empowerment and self-expression as perhaps the fourth module of their education. And what we're beginning to see is that the Amanis, the Marams and the Luais of this world, they are becoming children that you would recognize, children with the same kind of capabilities and qualities. And that's because they're beginning to receive the same kinds of opportunities of our own children. So we would love to repeat that. We would love to expand the school in Shatila. We would love to create a school in Bekaa. We would love to make sure that those schools are of the highest quality, teaching competitive sports at the weekend, teaching academic subjects to international levels during the week.
That's a fabulous ambition. I mean, if anything we can do to help, and I think lots of people listening will want to help. It's a glorious project. It's a fantastic thing to do. It's in one of the parts of the world which most desperate need of hope. But what you saw from the children was their enthusiasm and joy and how much they were getting out of it and how much they were bringing into it. It was fantastic to talk to you.
It was absolutely fantastic to talk to you, Richard, and earlier to the 3 children. Thank you so much for being with us.
And to your superb coach, by the way. I'd like to thank him.
Thank you.
I watched him teaching. To watch somebody teaching cricket so well, obviously with such enthusiasm and such technical expertise, his backward defences were just immaculate. And can we also thank Mohammed Hariri, the coach we watched play so well, for doing the translation for us.
And let me extend the invitation that Peter and Richard, I'm extending to you, to come visit, to anyone who is listening. The best thing that anyone could do to support us is to come visit. We would show you Shatila, we would show you Bekaa, you'd play cricket in the playground with our children, you'd you would see our school. And the second best thing is just to make contact. So if you do go to www.alzheimerproject.com, you'll find ways of doing that. We love to make connections, and we would love to make connections with people who are listening to this podcast. Thank you so much. Thank you.
I hope very much to see you in Beirut before very long.
We would love that.
In the meantime, it's goodbye from Peter O'Bourne. The sun is out here in frosty Wiltshire.
It's goodbye from me, Richard, or I think as I should be properly, Rashid. Goodbye from me in an equally sunny southeast London.